Bowser and Barry. I'm your host, Jeff Bowser. With me, my co-host, Barry Rose. A slightly more solemn approach to the podcast this week is we have decided to do a tribute to a true wrestling legend, and that is the Bullet, Bob Armstrong. Barry, tough couple of days with the loss. Not completely unexpected. A man that was battling cancer for quite a while. A man that had recently just lost his wife of 60 years. Bob Armstrong.
Yeah, it really is. It's really sad. Bob Armstrong, too, was, I think, my second favorite wrestler when I was a kid growing up. Jack Briscoe was my first favorite. And then Bob Armstrong came into the territory around 1974. And he had this amazing way, this amazing charisma, the way he could connect with an audience. And it was one of these things that you had to see to believe. And as a kid, I guess I was 10, 11 years old, I just was able to connect with that. And he was just so spectacular. And then you meet him. And as a kid, I met him. And then you and I met him, Jeff, and I guess it was 2005 in Tampa at Wrestle Reunion. And literally, you couldn't have asked for a nicer, more humble, more warm and engaging human being. So this one hurts a little bit. This one stings. And I know, you know, the same, you saw Bob. Did you see Bob in Georgia, right?
Yeah. And, you know, one thing, we have some guests that are joining us this
week
to discuss. Yes, we are joined by a veteran referee, Nick Patrick, son of Jody Hamilton, the original assassin, to discuss his memories of Bob in Georgia. We're going to be joined by Les Thatcher, who has been friends with Bob for over 50 years. Ron Fuller, the Tennessee stud, who may or may not have a podcast on this very same Arcadian Vanguard podcast network. Ron and Bob were best friends for, probably over 30 years, maybe even close to 40, Barry. And finally, Steve Kern, who discusses his memories with working with Bob in Georgia and different parts of the country. And, you know, the one thing that all four of them said, and this is, you know, we're not breaking any news here, is that Bob was just a great guy. And in a business where a lot of times it's maybe hard to find guys that are really great guys, Bob was pretty much universally thought of as a great guy.
Yeah. So how many guys out there, Jeff, have you never heard in professional wrestling, guys that worked the old territory system? How many of those guys have you never heard a negative word about? Bob Armstrong? Coach, yeah. John Heath, Don Curtis, and does the list stop there? is that it?
Not only that, but a guy that was married to his wife for 60 years. How rare, yep, is that in the world of professional wrestling? So we had a chance to speak to these four guys about their memories of Bob Armstrong. So why don't we first go to referee Nick Patrick to discuss his memories of the late Bob Armstrong. Okay, so Barry, we are very happy to be joined on a somewhat sad occasion by venerable referee Nick Patrick, of course, the son of Jody Hamilton. I like to call him the original assassin. And, you know, we wanted to talk a little bit with you because you obviously knew Bob, Bob Armstrong. You were there for somewhat of his career. So the first question I want to ask you, you know, what's the first memory you have as you look back on your friendship with the late Bob Armstrong?
My first memory is I was a little boy back in the day, and it's back when kayfabe was very much alive and a part of the business. And if you didn't kayfabe, you got fired. And we were in the Atlanta territory, and they had an old building, the old Atlanta City Auditorium. And whenever the guys brought their families with them, there was a place up on the stage. You know, the baby faces had one side and the heels had the other. And I remember, because my dad was always a heel and Bob was always a baby face up here, at least when they were in the same territory. And I remember seeing Bob's family over there and the boys, which I ended up becoming friends with every one of them down the road. But I remember him from there. And one of my earliest memories is back when I was a little kid in the summer, during the summer when I wasn't in school, my dad would take me on shots with him. And we was on our way down to Americus, Georgia one time. And I don't know if anybody knows, but Bob used to be definitely afraid of snakes.
And yeah, I've heard those stories before. Yeah, absolutely.
So we're driving on our way down there, and Pops runs over a snake. And my dad, I don't know if you know how well you know it, but my dad was always a river. So he got the bright idea of stopping and get this snake. And the snake was still kicking a little bit, but he wrapped it up in a towel and threw it in his trunk and brought it with him to the matches. Now, when we got to Americus, Americus was like an old, they had livestock shows there and stuff. And the locker room, the heels had a closed-in locker room. But the babyface locker room was terrible. It was just a bunch of plywood all nailed together, didn't have a roof over the top of it. It was in the back of the building. And, you know, they could go right out the door and be at the entrance, but still it was, you know, they got the worst end of the deal. So Pop waited till everybody was getting dressed. It was a little bit before showtime. He went and get that dadgum dead snake out of the back of his trunk. And I remember him creeping over there to the side and pitching that snake over the top of that line. There wasn't no roof over the top of the locker room for the baby faces. And you could hear that snake go whap and hit the floor. And it was like just a pause of about, it felt like about 10 seconds. And all of a sudden, it was like in the cartoons, the walls of that kind of bowed out. And you could hear everybody go, what? Everybody in the locker room started scuffling. Well, we saw the door get kicked open. And there was a Latino wrestler there, and I can't remember his name. It didn't end up being one of the huge guys. He was like, you know, one of the, he was upper middle card. I can't remember his name, but anyway, he was like going to be the first one out the door, but Bob was right behind him, and Bob just caught him and moved him, just picked him up with both hands and just moved him out of the way, and he was the first one out the door. And that Latino guy come out, and he hooked the right, and he went running past where all the cars were parked, and it was just a big old open field in the back. And my dad yells out there, "Amigo, that's where I killed the snake." And the guy goes, he started screaming again and come running back across the field. But that was my first real vision of Bob, was coming running out of that locker room from that snake. But I remember him, you know, as a child, watching him several times whenever my dad would take me to the matches, you know. But like I said, kayfabe was such a big thing. It was funny. My parents, my mom never ever met Bob's wife ever until about a year ago. You know, because of kayfabe, you know, and their lives paralleled so much. It was funny, you know, because I've known all of them, and she and they know me, and my mom's known all the Armstrong boys and Bob, but never ever met her. And they had a legend signing in Carrollton, Georgia, and Bob and his wife came up, and they had him sitting right next to me and my dad and my mom. And they finally got to meet after all the years. This is just a little over a year ago. This is right before she ended up having some health problems. And it was funny because all growing up, me and the boy, especially once I got to become friends with all the sons, we always talked about how much their lives paralleled, you know, because my high school sweethearts and marriages surviving the business and having children in the business, the territories that they went to were all the same territories. And, you know, their lives just paralleled so much, but they'd never met. And they end up sitting next to each other. And my mom and Bob's wife, they sat there and talked the whole night like they were best friends and knew each other forever. Well, they had a lot to talk about because, you know, like I said, their lives were virtually the same.
They had so much in common, probably, right?
Oh, yeah. They knew all the same people, but they never really knew each other because of old kayfabe.
Yeah. So how many territories did you personally work with Bob in? I know that your dad was with Bob off and on for years in several territories all throughout the South, but on a personal level for you, Nick, how many territories do you think you worked with Bob in?
For me, it was two. At Georgia Championship Wrestling, before it became actually WCW, that's when that's pretty much where I broke in, and then Brad too. I started in Kansas City in a smaller territory, and he was down in Pensacola starting in a smaller territory. But our first break in a, you know, I guess we considered an A-level territory back then. There was like five that you really wanted to get in that you could make some money, and Atlanta was one of them. We were fortunate to be in that spot. But that's where I first met Bob, was there. And he was responsible, once the Crocketts ended up buying Georgia Championship and ended up getting turned into the beginning stages of WCW. I had started wrestling at the time. They did a little angle with me and Bob Root. And then all of a sudden Crockett come and bought everything. And I knew that they didn't have any plans for me as a worker. And I wanted to be a worker. So Bob was booking Pensacola, and my dad was down there working as the Flame at the time. And a spot opened up. Poor Johnny Rich was at a party with Tommy. And they ended up getting in a beef with some people, and Johnny got stabbed and he got hurt. He was out for a little while. And they needed somebody to fill in his spot. And my dad told Bob that I was available, you know, because I was kind of in between there. And he's the one that brought me down to Pensacola right before I went to work for Watts for a while. And I got a good 6-7 month run down there, and it was awesome. It was one of the most fun territories I ever worked in.
You know, one of the things about Bob and his legacy, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you this, is that one of the, in my opinion, one of the great promo men of all time, just a guy that could just talk his way into a program, and some thoughts and memories about Bob on the stick.
He was awesome on the microphone and had ring psychology. It was unbelievable. And I think back when that Pensacola era time when I was down there wrestling, I was tag team partner with a couple of his sons at the time. And we used to watch the matches, and my dad was in the big angle against Bob. And we were at that stage. We were really young. We was going out there and working hard and damn and boom, bam, bumping, moving, bam. And we'd go out there and we'd watch Pop and we'd watch Bullet. And those two would go 10 minutes before they wouldn't even touch each other for 10 minutes. And the people would be dadgum having a riot, not because they were mad that they weren't touching, but they were so into the characters. And it was like, wow, how do they do that? You know, it was like 10 minutes before they even touched each other. And as soon as the bell rang, we were young. We weren't working smart. We were working hard, you know, but I used to laugh about that. We were just like, gosh, we're killing ourselves. And look at that. Look, it's 10 minutes. They hadn't even touched yet. it was good days.
Yeah, and Jeff's talking, and you're talking about Bob being one of the great promo men. Your father, many will say, is, you know, in the top five of great promos, and you always hear the words very menacing, a very heel-like, very scary type of promo. With Bob, though, and this kind of struck me, I never heard anyone ever say a negative word about Bob. And in professional wrestling, that is super unique. Because somebody's always got something to say, right? But with Bob, you don't hear a negative word. You did mention that you know his sons. How is your relationship with all of his boys?
They're all like brothers to me. I've been and traveled and worked with each one of them all at different eras in time. I broke in with Brad.
Are you and Brad about Scott the same age?
I'm about a year and a half older than Brad. But it was very close. And anyway, I worked with him in the Georgia Championship in WCW, and then in Pensacola, I worked with Scott and Steve, and I met Brian down there. When I was working in Pensacola, Brian was still just a kid in school, and I used to go over there and work out at Bob's house. He had this big gym set up out in his carport, and me and the boys would be out there training, and Brian had a bunch of little friends from school that wanted to check out Bob and check out the brothers, you know, and they'd come down and say, hey, I'll cut the grass for you if you let me in. And Brian, it was like he'd watched the movie Tom Sawyer or something. He had all these different neighborhood kids coming down there, cutting the grass for him with that push mower. Just all of them. It was a wonder they could cut a straight line because it was all watching the boys work out, trying to meet Bob. And Brian would just kind of like be jogging beside next to him, talking to him. It was like, I laughed at him. I said, man, I said, he's going to be in the business. He's already working people.
Well, you said that you worked in the two areas with Bob, because Georgia Championship Wrestling had that national audience that it could appeal to. But do you feel that his work in Southeastern, I guess, for lack of a better word, we'll call it, was as strong as the stuff in Georgia?
Yeah, Bob was an international star. You know, his everywhere he went, he was money. You know, back in the day, back in the day when Bob and my dad was going out and becoming international stars, it wasn't because they saw you on this one big main TV and you was already a star because they saw you off of that TV. You had to go over and get over in all these different places, and your reputation had to precede you, you know, before you got there. They had, you know, and so to be an international star back in the time that Bob and my dad were international stars is pretty amazing feat. You know, it's just, he was big everywhere he went, Japan.
Sure.
Everywhere now, in the States.
Were you in Georgia when Bob had the accident with the weightlifting?
Yes, I was. It was Georgia Championship Wrestling. Back when we first started going on those tours, we'd do a week in Georgia, and then we would go up to Ohio, and we'd do either Northern Ohio and Michigan, or we'd do Southern Ohio and West Virginia. And you'd throw a little Pennsylvania in there once in a while. It happened in Wheeling, West Virginia. It was a little small gym. And he was, of all exercises to call him, it was called Nosebusters. You know, that deal where you lay flat and you put your hands together and you bring the bar down your nose, and it's working triceps. And he was doing that, and the dadgum bench tipped and flipped on him, and the bar caught across underneath his nose and almost tore his nose off. And took a lot of surgeries, a lot of time for it to heal. But he was tough. He was back quick.
Yeah, I remember those days on TBS too. One of the things about Bob, and somebody posted this on social media this past week, that in a sense, Bob was Dusty Rhodes before Dusty Rhodes was that he was a guy that the everyday man was able to connect with. And Bob was gigantic down south. Do you feel that Bob could have been bigger, let's say in the Northeast or maybe out West? And I know that he was, in to some degree, was also a homesteader. He wanted to stay in the South, being that's where he felt most comfortable and obviously had his family. But do you think that Bob could have gone to, say, and connected with the fans in New York, or could have gone out West, maybe out in California or Texas, and connected with the fans out there?
I think Bob could have connected with fans anywhere he went, because he had the psychology, he had the look, he had the promo, you know, especially for that time era. You know, if he would have just, if he would have went to those places and would have had the promotion behind him, he'd have got over anywhere he went.
One of the stories that I read about Bob, this actually happened a few months ago, was that here he was racked with the cancer. And, you know, Nick, just for you, so that you know, I recently have gone through chemotherapy myself for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, so I can certainly identify with what he was going through. But Bob was battling bone cancer, but he was still working out. He was still lifting Wow. weights, and his son had gone and put, you know, something like 30 pounds on the bar. And Bob looked at
I saw
him,
that on Facebook.
Yeah, and said, rack it up with 100, you know, and here's the guy a few months away from dying of bone cancer, and he tells his son, put some more weight on that bar. So that just tells you everything you need to know about what Bob Armstrong was like, huh?
Yeah, well, I tell you, yeah, he was a pistol. He was very, very good man. And like you said, I've never heard anyone have a cross word about him. And Brad was the same way. I've never known Brad to have an argument with anybody or have a bad word with anybody. Now, all the other brothers, I've known every one of them to get in a scrape with somebody, you know. You know, so I can't say that about the whole rest of the brothers. But Bob and Brad, you know, and now don't get me wrong, Bob would stand for himself. He didn't take any mess. I don't think anybody wanted to mess with Bob. But they were just so nice, you know. If you had a problem with either one of those guys, you had to go look in the mirror.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting about Bob, too, Bob was a perennial babyface. Bob was a guy that spent literally his entire career. And then towards the end of his career, they did wind up turning him heel. Like that was Ron, I believe, down in the Continental area. And Bob got over huge, as a heel, which was amazing. So, you know, as we look back, and we're so grateful, first off, that you were able to join us too. And a little bit of a backstory. Today is Nick's father, the legendary Jody Hamilton, the as Jeff calls him, the original assassin. You got a little birthday party coming up, so we're extremely grateful that you took a little time to come and talk to us. But you've also got some stuff going on in your life right now, because I saw the big news. Deep South Wrestling is reopened.
Oh, yeah, I'm starting to crank it back up. We had all the equipment all left over from Deep South, and I had a ring set up. My pops got a big old metal building set up on his property. And my youngest son was kind of interested in breaking in, so we set the ring up, and he got more interested in the technical end of it. And thank goodness, because he's doing really well for himself now. In fact, he'll be home tonight for Pop's dinner. He was working for NBC Sports down in Daytona, filming the racing down there this weekend. So Tony's doing great. But we had that set up, and I got contacted by a bunch of local kids just looking for a place to work out. And I didn't really, you know, have plans on, you know, opening up a school or anything. But I had so many people contact me. What I started doing was renting my ring out to experienced guys, you know, per hour in small groups with all this pandemic stuff going on, you know, guys that are already working with each other, you know, renting it so I can clean it in between and stuff. And it's just turned out to where I got a core group of about 6 to 8 guys that we're going to start putting together a show and putting it on the website and putting it on all the social media so these guys can have a chance to. These are all local guys that are really good workers, you know, and I kind of want to show what they're doing, their level of dedication, you know, because in the independents, you'll find all kinds of people. But the ones that I have the most respect for are the ones that come out there. They have a good job, but they love wrestling, and they come out there and they work hard, and they're really interested, and they try to learn, and they train, you know, they get their bodies right. You know, they didn't just order a pair of boots and a pair of tights on the internet so they can go and tell everybody that they're a wrestler. You know, they're putting in the work and putting in the time to truly learn the craft and to become as good as they can be. And I want to kind of show that story through the show that we're going to put together and, you know, show that they're real kids. You know, they've got families, they got lives, they got jobs. They're finding time to do the work, you know, to do their job and finding time to get to the gym and finding time to come down to our hot butt building in the summertime and sweat and put in time in the ring, you know. And I just kind of want to tell their stories. And I want to set up a website, which we're in the process of putting together. So when people watch the show and they see the matches, that they can look up a bio on the kid and find out information on him and find out locally, if, you know, how to book him. If they want to book him, they can contact me through there and set it up where if the kids have merchandise they want to sell, then people can reach them and sell their merchandise. So that was my goal. We got all that in the fire right now. So we got 6 kids ready for the first show, and it should be coming up fairly soon.
Well, there you go. Well, listen, Nick, we certainly want to say thank you. We appreciate you coming and sharing some memories of the legendary Bullet Bob Armstrong with us. Barry and I and Sweet Lou, we want to encourage you to please wish your dad a happy birthday for us. All big, big fans of not only his, but yours too. And thank you so much for joining us and sharing your memories with us.
Well, thanks for having me. And I'd like to close out by saying God bless all the Armstrong family right now. They're going through a really hard time. They've got 2 kicks in the gut right back to back, losing their mama first and then losing Bullet here just a couple of days ago. So God bless all of them. And thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Thanks, Nick. We appreciate it, buddy.
All right, brother. Bye.
Okay, Barry, we are very happy to be joined on this somewhat sad occasion by a legendary figure in the wrestling business, not only as a wrestler, but as a broadcaster. That is Les Thatcher. Les, thank you so much for joining us today to discuss the career and life of Bob Armstrong.
You know, it's a mixed bag, obviously. I'm happy to be with you guys to discuss a dear, dear friend for a long time. But, of course, it's a sad occasion as well. You know, even when you're expecting something like this, and of course knew it was coming, just not ready for it. That's, man, when I turned the computer on yesterday morning, or was it Friday morning? Yeah. And saw that Bob had passed. I mean, I just sat here and I cried like a baby, to be honest. We've been friends for 54 years, so it's, you know, so much to remember and such a bittersweet time.
So there's no place to start like the beginning, Les, if I could ask you, what was the first time you met Bob?
That would have been 66 in Atlanta. My first time to work for the Atlanta office, and that's when we first met. Actually, we bonded for other reasons as well. Both of us loved hot rods. I had a 64 GTO. Tri-Power 389. He had a Chevelle 396. So, you know, we bonded over that, but we both were big fans of 50s doo-wop groups as well. So other than the wrestling between the hot rods and the music, we hit it off really well.
Gotcha. And you and Bob, I'm going to assume in having such a long relationship and being friends for 54 years, you must have made a lot of road trips together. Did you spend a lot of time on the road with Bob as well?
Yeah, you know, we did get a lot of road trips in together. And I mentioned the music. One of the things that we did, especially just the two of us, to kill time is we'd play a game. Bob would give me the name of a song from that era, and I'd have to tell him who the group was. And then I'd give him a name of song, and he'd have to give me the group. So that's one of the ways we'd fill that time. But yeah, we were brothers of the road as well.
So that's something that not only you and Bob had in common. I believe Ric Flair is a big fan of 50s doo-wop, if I remember, because I have a friend that used to work for a music distributor, and he used to hook Ric up with the 50s doo-wop stuff. So that's kind of interesting. Apparently, that's
is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Ric had kept that a secret. We might have invited him to some of our parties if we didn't.
So listen, you know, as we discuss the life and legacy of Bob, you know, one of the things I always say about Bob is Bob, and I'm not breaking any new ground here, one of the great promo guys, I think, in the history of the business, especially a guy when you say right off the top of your head, oh, tell me the best promo guys in the history of the business. And, you know, names like Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes, Terry Funk, Jerry Lawler, they kind of roll off the tongue. But Bob Armstrong, I think, is forgotten. But boy, that guy could put some butts in the seat, Les.
Yes, he could. He was the king of the Southern babyface promo, no doubt about it. Yeah. When Bob told you he was going to step in the ring with somebody on Friday night and kick their butt, you could go to the bank with that. But, you know, and the same thing, I mean, that was such a diverse personality. I mean, he was a badass if you pushed the wrong buttons, but just a personable gentleman, that Southern gentlemanly type thing as well, you know. But yeah, his promos and the fans, he connected. I mean, that was the thing too. There was such a chemistry between he and the wrestling fans. I'm living in Knoxville currently, but I know here that when Bad to the Bone started playing in the old Knoxville Coliseum, the place would go nuts. And, you know, it was not uncommon for Bob to come out on his way to the ring, and he might see a couple of grandmothers sitting, you know, near the aisle. It wasn't uncommon for him to step in an empty chair and sit down and say, "How are you, Grandma?" You know, and just and have a conversation on his way to the ring. So, yeah, he bonded with, I mean, that was the thing. There was no doubt he drew money, but it was as much his personality as it was his in-ring work.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, too. And we were talking with Nick Patrick, the son of Jody Hamilton, the Assassin. And Bob was one of those guys that you never hear a negative word about. People within the industry, it's almost universal. That's a very, I think you're in this group as well, Les. That's a very small core group that everybody has something positive to say. But towards the end of his career, he turned heel. And I believe you were there for part of that, correct?
Well, you know what? I only actually worked with, because we were both baby faces for the predominantly most of our career, I only worked with him actually in ring twice. In 66, Roger Kirby and I had given our notice we're going to Louisiana for Lee Fields. And so I worked with Bob in a babyface match in Savannah, Georgia, the first time we ever worked together. And then for a brief time that he was a heel here in Knoxville, mid-70s, he and I worked together once here as well. And the one thing I told him after we got done working here in the mid-70s, he hadn't gotten a bit looser. He's still stiff as hell. Just loosen up.
You mentioned working in Savannah, and I've mentioned on the show more than once, but of course you don't know. Savannah, the Civic Center, was the first building I ever saw matches in.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a great building. So, you know, we were talking about his ability on the microphone and stuff like that. And, you know, he had almost like a Southern rap to him in his interviews. And,
yes,
you know, about a week before the news broke that he had passed away, I was actually riding in the car with my wife. And I actually use the expression like a duck on a June bug. And, you know, here Bob hasn't worked, you know, on a national, you know, broadcast. I didn't have access to, you know, the stuff in Dothan and Southeastern. But, you know, here's an expression that I probably heard from Bob Armstrong almost 40 years ago. And I'm still using the expression.
Sure. Well, you know, but that's the guys from our generation that really got into your head. You're going to remember stuff, you know. You were talking about great promos, and of course, it's got nothing to do with Bob necessarily, but I know when I talk to trainees about promos and so forth, I'll say, you realize how many guys I have interviewed, you know, when while I was handling television for different territories. But I said, you know, Blackjack Mulligan had a cast of characters, and I can sit here and almost give you that cast of characters. That's how his promos were ingrained into my subconscious. But, you know, you're right.
Call
with
Mama
Bob,
from the kitchen. That was Blackjack's standard line.
Yeah. And his ranch foreman, Spider Grip, right? And the lovely rodeo queen, Betty Jo Puckett. That was her name. Yeah.
That's right. Haven't heard that in years. So as we're looking at Bob's career, and this was something I also posed to Nick, Bob was primarily known as a Southern wrestler, and I think a lot of it, he was a homesteader. He wanted to be closer to his family. He felt comfortable. Do you feel that Bob could have made it on a national level, like where Bob was never in the Northeast or out West in California or, you know, working for Don Owens or something? Could Bob have taken that charisma, because he really did connect with the crowd, could he have taken that and brought that to the Northeast?
I don't even have to stop and think about it. Absolutely. Bob could have worked for any territory at any time and would have had to been figured into the top matches. If the booker wasn't crazy or blind, one of the two. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, but you're right. It was about the family thing, especially with the boys. You know, they kept the home in Marietta for so long simply so the boys could finish school. And Bob worked here in Knoxville. He worked the Nashville territory, of course, Atlanta, Mobile, you know, but they didn't actually move the family into Pensacola until, you know, it was all settled and everything. So, yeah, I know for a fact he could have been one of the top guys in the Carolinas. George Scott would have been happy to have him. And Bob, at that point, just wasn't interested in getting that far away from his family.
So, you know, one of the things I've been listening to, I've been catching up on the Studcast, the spot where I'm at now. Ron Fuller was discussing Bob's run with people like Toru Tanaka and the great Mephisto, which, of course, you were such a big part of that. And Ron was talking about just how huge Bob got over with the folks in Knoxville. Could you tell us about that?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, he was, wow. You know, yeah, I would say he was over. It transcended Ron, Robert, or any of the baby faces here over a period of time. And I can go all the way back here to into the 60s when Whitey Caldwell and I were the first baby faces to get over on John Cazana's television in 1969. And Whitey was a local legend as well. But I think you could, you know, pretty much put Bob Armstrong, you know, in that same category. I mean, Whitey, when he was killed in a car wreck back in the 70s, and I know for a fact that for years he lived up in the Tri-Cities, that people went to his grave on the anniversary of his passing and left flowers for years after he was gone. But yeah, Bob was equal, I'd say, to Whitey in this area as far as being over, completely over. I'll tell you something about Bob. I don't know if anybody mentioned it. It's been on with you guys yet. But as much as a gentleman as he was, as friendly as he was, as badass as he could be if you pushed the wrong button, he was scared to death of snakes.
Nick just told us a story about Bob's fear of snakes.
Is that right? Yeah. Well, I do a podcast on the Observer site on Fridays, and I mentioned there when we were during the War of Atlanta, 73 and 74, and I was down there doing the TV in Atlanta with Gordon, but then I was also handling the TV in Macon as well. And the baby faces in Macon were, their dressing was basically a large closet. It wasn't very big at the TV station. But I forget who it was. And I didn't realize at this point in time either, you know, somebody had this rubber snake and they said, put that under your sport coat. And when you go in the babyface's dressing room to talk about the show, toss that to Bob. Damn. So I forget who it was that was sitting next to Bob. When I tossed that rubber snake, Bob came up out of that chair. The other guy trying to get out of his arm swinging, Bob was just swinging wild. He was knocked something over. So what, the guy sitting next to him fell off his chair. Guys were diving to get out of the way. But yeah, it was crazy. I said, you know, what a great finish some heel can come up with, right? Bob plays bad to the bone, gets in a ring and ready. That heel walks out and pulls a rubber snake out from under his robe. And the great baby face takes off running. So.
I'm trying to think, was there any great heel in Southern wrestling that Bob didn't face?
Wow, there's probably been a few. Realize my career, we both started in 1960. Bob is actually just a year and 25 days older than me. I'll be 80 October the 28th. He would have been 81 on the 3rd of October. So, my God, to give you a list.
Right off the top of your head, if you could think of, like, you know, because, you know, about the story about the snake. The guy that I always associate with the snake is, of course, the Sheik up in Detroit. And sure. I was like, well, I'm sure he never faced the Sheik. So was there somebody in the South that over the course of his life, as many years as his career had in it, was there somebody that somehow he didn't face?
I would guess that the territories he worked in from the time they really started pushing him, which that would have been, I'm going to guess, around 1970, probably, maybe earlier than that, too. But I would say in the territories he worked in, there wasn't a top heel that he didn't work a program with at some point. And, you know, you could guess they were all great, too. Mick Foley had posted something on the internet about watching Bob during Mick's last days with Continental, where Bob is working with a young man who didn't have a lot of experience. And Mick made the point that This young man probably didn't know how good he was going to look until Bob made him look that good. And it made him look like he was a star, and he may never look that way again. But you probably have heard the story. You know, so-and-so could have a match with a broomstick. Bob was that same guy. And, you know, there were a lot of guys that were that talented back in our era, because telling a story is more important than it is currently. And we all had to learn to build matches on the fly. There was no such thing as laying a match out in the dressing room. So there were a lot of top flight guys. But yes, Bob could take a mediocre talent in the ring and make that mediocre talent look better than he probably could make himself.
Well, so as we look back on the career of Bob Armstrong, who the wrestling world lost this past week, Les, if I said to you, give me one memory of Bob, other than doo-wop songs in the car, which you've already shared, one strong memory of Bob, what would that memory be?
Oh, wow. I guess, you know, if I had to put a picture in my mind's eye right now, it would be him in his, now what I'm going to say, his butcher suit, the slingless, right? The low-cut slingless with the straps. That's
sure.
What we called
right.
we called the butcher suit. I can see him and see him starting that, I don't know, dance or that strut when he's getting ready to make his comeback. And, you know, with his facials and body language, that entire arena or auditorium or wherever he was at is coming right along with him. That would be the picture that I would remember. And, of course, hanging out at the pier at Pensacola Beach, it wouldn't be a bad thing to remember either. We used to do that quite a bit. But you know what? Bob has left his mark on this business. He's put a big footprint down, and I don't know who's going to write the real history of this business someday, but he's got to be a damn sure prominent part of that history, believe me.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. Well, you know, Les, before we let you go, I did want to ask my co-host Barry, who, of course, runs the CWF page discussing the history of championship wrestling from Florida. Barry, first of all, when was the first time that Bob showed up in Florida? And what was his most prominent time as far as, like, you know, getting a run with one of the titles down there?
Oh, absolutely, too. And here's the funny thing, Jeff. Bob was one of my first favorite wrestlers. I think it was probably Jack Briscoe followed by Bob. And he showed up in 1974 and came in. It was an immediate push, too. Literally, I think within his first or second week, he was in the main events. He wound up winning the North American title. And this was the title that Bill Watts, who had had a falling out with Leroy McGurk, Watts left the tri-state area, Mid-South, and came down to Florida with the title. And Bob actually was the North American champion for a while. And he was a really big deal. And Bob's timing was great because this was prior to Dusty Rhodes turning babyface. And this was Jack Briscoe had already won the NWA World's Heavyweight title. So there was kind of this gap right there where the state was looking for a babyface. And I would say by de facto, it was Bob and Paul Jones. So Bob came in. Bob had a great run, probably lasted about a year. And then we saw him every so often on and off. Came in late 75, had a babyface match on Miami Beach, Jeff, against Billy Robinson for the Southern title. And I got to tell you, that match was 45 years ago, and I clearly still remember this match. It was that good. And then he came in and worked with Pac Song a few times in 1976. We didn't see him a whole lot after that, but Bob was a guy. And the amazing thing, when you think about it, this is what I think to me makes a great babyface. Bob could connect with the crowd in Griffin, Georgia, and Bob could connect with the crowd on Miami Beach. And let me tell you, a Miami Beach crowd is very different than a Georgia crowd.
Yeah.
Yet, exactly. Yet he was able to connect with both to the point that he was super over. So rest in peace, Bob Armstrong. I will miss you on a personal level. A true gentleman and just an amazing professional wrestler.
So, Les, we really want to say that we appreciate your time in this very sad occasion, losing your friend, the great Bob Armstrong. But we certainly appreciate you coming and joining us and discussing some of your memories of the pier in Pensacola and doo-wop songs and hot rods. So we appreciate your time, sir.
Well, listen, I appreciate you guys giving Bob this kind of a send-off because he deserves it, believe me. He was a great competitor, a hell of a human being and a dear friend. Love him so much. And we'll remember him with much love and respect from this point forward. So, and thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, Les, before you go also, will you come back and actually chat with us about your career in the next month or so? Awesome.
Sure. You've got my number.
I do. You got it, Les. Right. Thank you so much.
Sure, I'd be happy to hang out with you guys. Thanks. And you guys have a good weekend. Take care.
Thank you, Les. You too.
Bye-bye.
Barry, we are extremely happy and honored to be joined by a man that considered Bob Armstrong, if not one of his best friends, his very best friend in the wrestling business. And that is the man, the Tennessee Stud himself, the host of the Studcast, Ron Fuller. Ron, on behalf of Barry and Lou, thank you so much for joining us in this somewhat sad occasion to talk about your friend, Bob Armstrong.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. And glad to be on. Always like being on with you guys. It's a pleasure. And certainly, we're talking about something that's a little bit sad. It's a sad subject at this point, but man, anything I can do to add credence to what this guy accomplished in the ring and in his life, I'm more than happy to.
Okay, so like I've done with the two previous guests, it's always good to start at the beginning. Tell us when you first met Bob Armstrong. What was the occasion? Where were you at? That kind of thing.
First time I remember meeting Bob, I was in junior in high school, 1965. Bob was just beginning, just starting. And I went with my dad down to the Atlanta Auditorium, where they had the matches every Friday night for Georgia Wrestling. And Bob was on that card. And I had seen him a couple of times before. Back in those days, my dad was kayfabing me and my brother. You know, so we didn't really get to go in the dressing room very much. But on that particular night, Bob came out and there was a big stage there. You could kind of stand in the back and people couldn't see you from the major part of the auditorium. And Bob came to me and he said, you're Buddy Fuller's son. Yeah. And we had our first conversation together. I was just extremely impressed by his body. I mean, it was like, wow. And I was thinking to myself, God, if I could just work out with this guy, man, I'd get somewhere.
There really weren't a lot of guys that were into the weightlifting back then, I'm guessing. And he must have been one of the few that really were one of the first ones that really started working on defining his body.
Yes, he was way ahead of everybody else with that part of it. And he worked out a lot with a guy named Daryl Cochran, who also had a great body. You know, and at that point, I was 6'6" and I weighed 160 pounds. So, you know, I was looking for muscle, any kind of muscle, any way I could get it. And I would give anything to work out with him some.
When you first met Bob, was he working full time? Was he still a fireman at that stage?
I think he was still doing some fire. He was still a fireman at that point, I believe. Since you mentioned the fireman thing, I don't know if y'all ever heard the story, but Bob, when he was, this was about the same time frame, I believe, as when I met him. They had a big, big fire, and it was a brush fire type of deal. He was driving the big old fire truck, and it was a brand new one. Very expensive, obviously, those things are. And the fire got away from him, and they were about to lose the truck. It was going to burn up the truck, and there was a little lake there, and Bob drove the truck off into the lake to save the fire truck. And I don't know if you guys have heard that story.
No, I hadn't heard that one.
Bob drove it off into the lake and, you know, it didn't sink. It went down, you know, above the tires. They had to come and hook up the couple big tow trucks to it to pull it out. But, you know, Bob told me when he told me this story, he said, I thought, man, he said, right then, he says, they're going to get rid of me, man. I have lost my job, man, because I've destroyed the truck. And he said the fire chief came and told him, he said, I can't thank you enough. He goes, you're the smartest fireman I think we've had here in years and years. He goes, you saved this truck. Hadn't been for you, that truck would have been ruined. So Bob said what he thought was turned into a horrible thing for him turned out to be a darn near promotion for him. And the fire chief was really, really in love with him after that. But yeah, so he drove the fire truck into the lake on purpose to save it.
So I have a two-part question for you there based on something you just said. You mentioned the name Daryl Cochran, and I know he worked for the Georgia office for a time during the time that Bob was also there. So I wanted to ask you what you knew about Darrell Cochran, but also as far as Bob goes, when he was getting into the business, who was the person that did his, you know, I know he was in the service and stuff like that, but who was the one that did Bob's initial training to get into the wrestling business, if you know?
I really don't know. We never got into much of that. And I think it could have been Darrell. Darrell Cochran was, I think he was a fireman too. And that's how they got to be so close. They worked out together all the time. And Darrell was a big guy like Bob, maybe even bigger than Bob, believe it or not. And Darrell worked for me in Continental in the mid-80s, from 84 to about 87. He used to come over from Atlanta because he liked to come and see Bob. And we would put him on the card. Darrell was actually working wrestling probably before Bob was. And I think if somebody trained Darrell, I mean Bob, it would probably be Darrell that get a lot of credit for that. I'm pretty sure not only was he training him in weights and working out with weights, but he was probably training him with a little bit of wrestling too. Darrell was a totally different style worker than Bob, though. You know, Darrell didn't have the fire, and Darrell wasn't going to be a top guy, and Bob just had it from the very beginning.
Yeah, and Jeff, we saw Darrell Cochran in Florida. I want to say it was 1976. And I think he actually came in with Bob. Bob came in, did a few shots, and Darrell was with him. Darrell had what it looked to be like a similar physique to Bob, and he had kind of this really cool handlebar mustache, if I'm remembering correctly. And I think he passed away a few years ago. So, Ron, you knew Bob for so many years. You worked with Bob in several different territories. You worked with Bob. You worked opposite against Bob. Give me some of your memories of being in the ring with Bob as an opponent. Bob had this amazing, at least in my opinion, Bob had this amazing connection to the crowd where he could get a crowd going, like really like nobody else at that stage could. What was it like to be facing him in a match?
It was wonderful, actually, because he was such a great worker. He was very light in the ring. He wasn't a stiff guy, but he was always there. If you called a spot, he was right there, man. He was fast. He was extremely strong, obviously, and very smooth with a whole lot of things he did. And he had that ability to fire the crowd up just by making a couple of little moves. Sometimes he'd just spin around in a circle two or three times, and then he'd crank down like he's going to get into karate. And boom, he'd pop them, you know. And when I was working against him, I really loved working with him because he sold really good, too. And when he made his comeback, obviously the crowd would really pop. I liked the way he sold. He was light. But funny thing about Bob, he looks like he'd be heavy. But I used to suplex him a lot, and he hated it. He said, "Ron, nobody suplexes me as much as you do." I would backbreak him and suplex him because he was light for me. And when you pick him up, it's like, geez, you go to grab him and you think you're going to pick up a guy that weighs 280 and he feels like he weighs 180. You know, it's like, dang, man, he's light as heck. You know, so a lot of things about working with Bob were just absolutely wonderful. You know, his style was so good. He had so much fire. I think that was what Bob had that really kind of set him apart from a lot of baby faces, is he could really fire. And when he did, you know, like you said, the crowd was really into him, and that's what they were waiting on. He gave it to him a lot, and he gave it to him really good, too. I mean, he never ran out of gas. I never saw him get blown up, even close to being blown up, Bob, actually. He was a great dude to work with, really, really great.
So yesterday, when we were doing the recording of our interview with Les Thatcher, I told Les a story, and I mentioned it to Barry. I don't know if Barry had a chance to get the specific dates, but there was a story that came out in one of the obituaries I read online. I don't know if it was The Observer or what, that Bob had a match with Lou Thesz in the CWF rings. And before I finish the story, did you run across Bob when you both were in CWF at any point?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Bob was down in there at the same time I was there. Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know if this was at the same time you were there or not, but the story goes that the match was booked in Miami Beach at the Convention Center, and Bob was scheduled to meet, of course, the legendary Lou Thesz. And, of course, at this point, Lou was probably in his let's just say mid-50s, and you know, Bob was, of course, in his prime and really catching fire in the wrestling world. And Bob approached Lou in the dressing room, and he said, "Lou, do you want me to go easy on you tonight?" And apparently Luke pretty much tied Bob up in knots that night. In but yeah, I just thought that was a great story. And I wanted to ask, you know,
that sounds like Bob.
Yeah. Like yeah.
Bob. You know, and I, for Bob, he wasn't being a smart ass.
I mean, No. I don't think he's breaking the ice.
You know, he's kind of breaking the ice, you know, I think it probably made Bob feel more relaxed. Once he got that out of his system, he probably got a little more relaxed. You were pretty well uptight when you were working with Lou Thesz. I worked with him many times, you know, and he was the type of guy that you couldn't have a real, real laughable and fun conversation with Lou. He was so serious, and you figure he's going to take that into the ring. You're looking for a way to lighten things up a little bit, and I can see Bob doing that, saying, hey, I'll take it easy on you tonight, Lou. And I can see Lou getting a little uptight for that too, because he's looking at Bob, and Bob's a pretty big dude. You know, he knows this guy's got to be strong. So Bob has such a great sense of humor. Man, I've had millions of laughs with Bob. He's a rare individual, man.
Gotcha. So that match, Jeff, that you're referring to took place November 20th, 1974 on Miami Beach at the auditorium, which means I was there. I don't remember the match, but I would have been there for that. It was the sixth match of the night out of 8 matches. The main event that night, NWA World's Heavyweight Champion Jack Briscoe defeated Professor Toru Tanaka. Southern Champion Joe LeDuc defeated Pac Song. And then Bob Armstrong defended the North American title with a victory over Lou Thesz. What's interesting about this card, this was a solid card. You got Iron Mike McCord on the card, Danny Hodge, Eddie Graham, the Mongolian Stomper, just a host of great talents. This card only drew a little over 2,800 people. My guess, if I'm thinking, is that maybe this was the day before Thanksgiving, because that doesn't make any sense why, you know, that kind of. But so what's interesting about this is Bob was getting a huge push at this point. As we discussed yesterday during the recording, Bob was the North American champion, and Bob had gotten the title when Bill Watts came in after he had that falling out with Leroy McGurk, and he brought the North American title with him. But going back, even at this stage, Lou Thesz wasn't doing a lot of jobs. So for Lou Thesz to do the job for Bob, this shows a real sign of respect. Wouldn't you agree, Ron?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's kind of remarkable in a way, you know, because Lou didn't do a whole lot of jobs for people. And that's probably because of Watts. Watts had a real good relationship with Lou, and I'm sure he told him, you know, this guy's a good guy, and I really need to get him over. And he said the right things to Lou. And you said, Barry, that was in the month of November of 74?
Yeah, it was November 20th, Miami Beach.
I left there in October of 74, a month earlier. I just left there to go and open Southeastern Wrestling in Knoxville. And because I was thinking I might have been on that card too, and probably I would have been if I'd have stayed another month longer, no doubt. And that is a great card, and it is surprising that only drew 2,800 people. And if it was the Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, that's probably had something to do with it.
I think there's a lot of guys that ended up working with you up in Knoxville, huh?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. A lot of those guys you just mentioned. You know, some of those guys that you just mentioned worked for me. Idol worked for me, obviously, in Pensacola. He didn't work much in the Knoxville area for me. But what we did with Continental, he went back with me with Continental and we went up there. But yeah, there quite a few of those guys were on the cards later on for me. But when I went to Knoxville, we were not doing very well and they didn't have any talent. They were dealing with Tennessee talent that was pretty sorry. And a lot of the talent was coming out of Nashville, and oh, it was a mess. It was a big step down from Florida wrestling, I can tell you that. Took us a while to get up to the stage of being anywhere near Florida wrestling.
Yes, and Bob stuck around too. Bob was here, I will say, till about April of the following year, of April of 75. Did he go with you to Knoxville at that point?
No, he did not go with me in 75, but he showed up for me in 76, about June of 76. Man, I couldn't wait to get him in because I had worked with him for a whole year down there in Florida, 73, 74. I was there basically from 70 to 74. And Bob was there quite a bit of that time. And I just saw his talent. And it was like, man, if I could ever get my hands on a guy like that, he'll make my territory. And basically, he just about did that. He came in and stayed for me. And I think he went back there. He stayed for me in the summer of 76 for about 3 months. And then I believe he went back to Florida maybe again. And then I got him back in 77. And he basically never left after that. I mean, he stayed with me in Knoxville. And then when I decided to go buy the Gulf Coast territory from the Fields brothers, I included him in that company's ownership because he was just a remarkable talent, great guy to work with, mind for the business, very good mind for the business, a quality person, period. I mean, just an amazing guy. Married to the same woman in the wrestling business for 60 years. I mean, wow. That
doesn't happen often.
That's a big statement right there, you know, that tells you what kind of guy he was.
Well, Ron, you know, as I have told you before we started recording, there's not a lot of podcasts that if I happen to miss a week's episode, I will save and go back and make sure that I listen to it. And the Studcast is one, actually, I probably will say other than this one, Barry, that I definitely do that with because it's always such a history lesson. And as fate would have it, the episode that I just finished was the one where you did the angle with the Great Mephisto throwing the fireball at Bob. And you had said that a lot of times what guys would – I think this was an answer to one of your listeners' questions – was that guys would come in, and on this occasion you said that's probably what Bob did, sort of be able to check out the territory, see if they wanted to commit longer term. But he came in for about a month or so before they did the angle with Mephisto, correct?
Yep. And he wasn't there very long. And when he came in, when he committed to say, Ron, I'm going to come up there and check it out. That's kind of basically the way he put it to me. I said, how long can you stay? And I was hoping he's going to say, oh, yeah, I'm going to stay a year or whatever. And, you know, well, Ron, I just want to see what it's like. And he came in and we were just getting started in 75. We really struggled in 75 building anything. And starting in the winter of 76, we had Don Carson, we had Dick Dunn and Tarzan Baxter, the superstars. And we got Tanaka in there. We got some better talent in there. And then when we got to the summer of 76, we brought Bob in and he kind of helped to pop it. And then, you know, I knew he was leaving. And I asked him, I said, would you do me a huge favor? Would you get Mephisto over? You know, can he throw the fire? And Bob says, absolutely, man. And he says, and then when he was going to leave to go where, and I think he went to Florida. I'm pretty sure he might have gone back to Florida. When he left that night that Mephisto hit him with the fireball, he told me, he says, Ron, I really like what I see here. And he goes, I'm going to come back. And he goes, I'm going to stay. I'm going to stay a lot longer. So he does come back two shows. He comes back for two shows in September, two Friday nights in September in 1976. Then he's gone until just about the end of 1976. And then 1977, we start a Cadillac tournament, and he's going to win that Cadillac tournament, and he ain't never going to leave. He's like, wow, man, this is heaven, you know, because he had those short trips. You were home every night by midnight, and he had never been in a territory like that. There weren't many territories like that where you could, you know, be home by midnight every night.
Yeah, and so touching on that, Ron, too, with short trips and things like that, Bob is primarily known as a Southern-style wrestler, and the fact that he never was working up north in the Northeast, really wasn't out on the West Coast. It literally tended to be the South, and I do think a lot of that was because his roots were in the South, his family, his boys, his wife. This is a question I posed to Nick Patrick and Les Thatcher as well. Had Bob decided that he wanted to run up north, how do you think he would have connected with the audiences and the crowds up north, comparatively speaking?
I think he would have lit it up. I think people would have gone crazy for his style up there. You know, and I always thought that, you know, WWF as an example, that you know, the Gorilla Monsoons and the Hogans and the big, huge bodies that, you know, the matches are slow and there's no fire. And, when I watch them, I'm like, gosh, how did they draw any money? And a guy like Bob would have just lit them up. Well, I'll give you an example. Joe Scarpa was a big star in the same time period as I talked about when I met Bob in 65. He was a big star in Georgia. And he went up there as Strongbow and just, you know, and one thing that Joe had was a lot of fire, you know, make a tremendous comeback, a pretty decent seller and a big, big comeback guy. And he went up and lit him up pretty darn good himself, you know, but I think Bob would have even been more successful than Scarpa was as Strongbow. Bob would have just become a massive star up there. Bob could have gone anywhere in the world and become a star. You know, he just had it all. And he had such respect from the boys. It's pretty amazing. You know, you never saw Bob have any words with anybody. Guys really respected him. And they had good reason to. But he was very nice. You know, he wasn't the type that was, you know, I'm here and I'm going to kick your ass if I need to. He never came across like that. He was just a rare, rare person.
You know, one of the things I mentioned with the other guest that we've had on to discuss with Bob is how great Bob was at getting the people into the arena with his promos. And he had almost like this Southern rap about him, if you would. He had the, you know, like a duck on a June bug. And, you know, it's like mind over matter. I don't mind because you don't matter. And these little catchphrases that connected him with the audience so well. So I hope this doesn't sound like a disrespectful question, but is it more important? You know, of course, the bottom line is always, you know, the register, the cash register. But once you get the people in the building, you got to get them to come back again. And I think that's what Bob, once Bob got him in the building, he had the ability in the ring to keep them coming back. Would that be fair?
Oh, yeah. Hell yes. I mean, you know, and he talked them into the building a lot. I don't know if y'all ever got to see Bob as a heel. When Bob turned heel, we did the angle in 1982 with the world championship match with me and Flair. And Bob was the referee, was a baby face. And he turned on me in that match. And Bob was, in my opinion, one of the greatest heels I ever saw. I mean, his whole personality changed. He grew a little mustache. He put an earring in his ear. He started smoking cigarettes during interviews. I mean, he just changed his entire attitude, and his persona changed so dramatically. People hated him. We did things that just lit him up. I mean, Brad had a match with Ricky Gibson, which is a great worker, babyface match, and Ricky Gibson hurt his leg. And Bob goes into the ring and he says, beat him. He's telling Brad, he says, beat him right now. And Brad says, no, I'm not going to do it, Dad. They have a little altercation there. And Bob slaps Brad. I mean, oh, bet this tore people up. Then he ends up slapping Charlie Platt a few weeks later. I mean, he had tremendous heat. So, you know, I mean, he could do anything. His interviews, he had his own imaginary character that a woman he called Fannie Mae Titwiler. Yeah, Fannie Mae Titwiler. And Fannie Mae just sent me a lot of money. Look at this gift Fannie Mae sent me. And he would have these presents from Fannie Mae Titwiler. Nobody ever knew what she looked like. And once I came back and started this baby face against him to get even, I used to go get this down. There was a brush guy that do the brush paintings on T-shirts in Pensacola Beach. And I had him paint up this big fat woman Look, my estimation of what Fannie Mae looked like, she had flies buzzing around her head and her arm around Bob's neck. And, oh, you know, we had such fun. It was just a joy to work with him. And you know, we bounced ideas off each other. And it was magical. It was a magical time frame. That Southeastern and Pensacola, that was a red hot territory. Wow.
Well, that's actually interesting that you bring up the whole Bob heel turn, because that was actually something that I was going to discuss with you before we left today. So here's a quick story I'll tell you about the effect that had in the local community. Is my older brother who's not a wrestling fan, but knew that I liked wrestling, actually called me one day and said, did you know that Bob Armstrong is like, he's a bad guy now? And I said, oh, and you know, of course I, other than the magazines, I didn't have any. And I said, really? And he goes, yeah. He goes, and he comes on and he's talking to the announcer and he's smoking cigarettes. So even people that weren't wrestling fans in that area had heard about Bob Armstrong turning heel. So it got over, you know, outside of the normal wrestling community, word got out that Bob Armstrong had turned on you. So I guess my next or follow-up question would be, whose idea was that? Was it Bob coming to you with it? Were you coming to Bob, sort of a mutual thing? How did that all come about?
Well, I kind of came up with the idea because what was happening in Bob's family was joined to make our territory tremendous. Because he had Brad at this point. Brad was just a fireball, man. He was a little Bob. And, you know, I could see Brad was, his future was just immense, you know. He also then behind him, he's got Steve coming. And he's got Scott coming. And he's got these boys that are about to all break in. And I sat with him and we rode on a trip. And I said, Bob, you know, we were both baby faces. And we talked to him, you know. We rode together and spent a lot of time together. And I said, man, why don't we turn you heel? And I said, you know, I got Rob and Jimmy and their baby faces. And you've got your boys coming up, you know. And then I said, well, and he says, well, what about my boys? I turned him heel. I said, no. I said, why don't we just leave them baby faces? And they hate you as bad as other people do, right? And, you know, and then we talked, and the more we talked about it, the more it just made sense. And what we did is we probably had a 5-year run with the Welches and the Fullers and the Goldens against the Armstrongs. And once we turned Bob back babyface, then we all switched heels. And I'd been healed a couple of times before, and it was easy. And I knew we were going to make big money with it. I didn't want to keep Bob forever as a heel. He was just too valuable as a babyface.
So, Ron, with losing Bob over the last week, and it's losing a link to the history of professional wrestling in the territories and the way things used to be. What's the legacy that Bob is going to leave?
Oh, geez, man. He's going to leave thousands and thousands and thousands of fans across the South never forgetting him. I put a little something on social media about, you know, my thoughts about Bob and losing Bob. And I'd just been, it's unbelievable. I'd never seen that type of, you know, everybody loved Bob Armstrong. He just, so, you know, he's got that. He's got the legacy of his son, Brad, who, in my opinion, was one of the greatest young workers that I ever saw. And, you know, was just phenomenal. And his other sons, you know, and Brian's been there, Steve's there, Scott's been there. You know, his family's history is completely and entirely made because of what Bob accomplished in his life. And, you know, there's some things that, you know, probably haven't been said about Bob, but, you know, Bob is he's not just a tremendous athlete and a tremendous worker in the ring and a tremendous interviewer. He's a tremendous human being. He was just a tremendous human being that everywhere he went, you know, even if people didn't know he was a wrestler, they would ask him questions and he was always so polite. I had a guy that sent a message on social media. And he says, Ron, I'm 50 years old. I think he said he was around 50 years old. And he said, Bob Armstrong, I went there with my daddy the first time I ever saw a wrestling match. And Bob Armstrong was in that match. And he said, wrestlers were selling pictures. And he says, well, I couldn't afford it. My daddy couldn't afford to buy me a picture. And he says, I stopped him on the way out and he shook my hand. And I asked him if he had a picture. And he said he didn't have a picture with him, but he said, to my daddy, he said, write down your address and give it to me. And Bob Armstrong, this guy says, Ron, Bob Armstrong sent me 8 or 10 pictures. And he took the time to write the belts that he was wearing on the back of them, what the time frames were, and sent them to him as a 10-year-old kid. He said, I'll never forget that, you know.
Wow, and, that's something, yeah.
You know, he just had a great, great heart. Bob did. And he was a bigger-than-life character. Fans will never forget him. I don't care how long wrestling goes. You know, these people that saw him wrestle and that shook his hand, and so many of them, Bob was so very, very nice to people. Except when he was a heel, he was absolutely legit. I mean, you know, I heard people that just loved him started to hate him because he would no longer talk to them. And he would flip them off, you know, get out of the way, you know, leave me alone. You know, and he did a great job of doing whatever character he was supposed to do. And, you know, and his what he accomplished in his life, his sons, I believe this is true, that all five of them are just like he was. He was married to the same woman for 60 years. And I don't believe any of his three sons that are still alive or have ever gotten a divorce. They're all married to the same woman, too.
Yeah, I will say that in a business where there's no disrespect meant, not a lot of truly nice guys, Bob Armstrong was always a guy that was mentioned as being one of the truly nice guys in the business, for sure. And Barry and I, over the course of over 150 episodes, have both echoed our appreciation for Brad and just what an incredible talent he was in the ring. But, you know, what I wanted to ask you as we start to slowly begin to wrap up this segment here, since the Studcast is so much about the history of the wrestling business, and since your family was so part of this particular part of wrestling history, I know you've discussed it on the Studcast in the past, but could you just briefly go over the part that Bob played in being the only guy that didn't leave Georgia and go with Ann Gunkel's All South Wrestling? He stuck there with part of the, he was the only one in the crew that I believe that remained. And what an integral part of the wrestling history it played in, at least in the state of Georgia.
Yeah. And that was a terrible situation for Bob. And he was left out. Because I think what happened there is there was a lot of discussion going on behind the scenes because most everybody in that crew knew what was coming, but they didn't go to Bob with it because I think they realized that, you know, Bob's liable to flip on us here. You know, he's liable to tell them what the heck's going on. And so, you know, Bob had that. It's a loyalty. It's a matter of loyalty. And Bob's loyalty was not just to the NWA. Bob had a lot of loyalty and a lot of great respect for the old promoter there, Paul Jones. I did too as a kid. I mean, Paul Jones was a legitimate tough guy, and he was a nice guy. Most everybody liked Paul, and Bob really liked Paul, and Paul liked Bob. Paul saw Bob's ability, and he saw a lot in Bob. When Bob was really, really young and getting started, he's one of the reasons Bob made it where he went so fast. But, you know, he had that relationship with him. He had been working for this one company. I just think he felt like in his heart that what the other company was doing was wrong. You know, he couldn't agree with that. And they brought him in, from what Bob told me, last person that she talked to, and everybody else had all gone the other way. And I think they knew Bob was not going to go with them. So she brought him in the last day before they did the deal and asked him to, you know, he told him what was going to happen. And would you go with us? And we really need you. She offered him a big guarantee, you know, go with us. We'll make you a big amount of money, you know, more than you're making working for them. And all of that stuff she's told him. And, you know, Bob said, you know, we've talked about this. And he said, you know, Ron, it just didn't make sense to me. You know, I didn't feel right about it. So it never happened. He's the only one that didn't go. I now think Darryl Cochran didn't go, obviously, because Bob and Darryl Cochran was a fireman, too. So, you know, they'd been friends for many, many years. And Darryl and Bob were going to go the same way. And once Bob made that decision, Darryl was all for it, too. He was going to go the same way.
Just to play devil's advocate, if Bob had gone with Ann Gunkel, do you think ultimately it would have made any difference with all the power of the NWA sending all those guys in? Or do you think it was, you know, it maybe would have just postponed the inevitable?
I think it would have postponed it. But, you know, it would have definitely made a difference. They would have had an even stronger crew. They would have had a great baby face. That's from Georgia, had the history of being in that state. he would have carried a whole lot of weight for him. But, you know, once the NWA really set their mind to stepping in and helping, there's just so much compared. And they had great talent. I got to hand it to them, man. Gunkel had some very, very good wrestlers in that crew. She had Dickie Steinborn. She had the Assassins. She had Ox Baker. She had a lot of pretty darn good names in that crew. But you can't. Nobody during those days could have competed with what they were throwing at her. And they were really throwing some bombs at her, some big dudes and big names. And it was a steady pressure for them. And Bob could have probably made it last a little longer for her, but I don't think he could have withstood all that that tremendous talent that went through there and toward the end of that war.
So one of the things, Ron, and this will be the last question I have for you here before we wrap up this segment, that I read on social media. And this was going back, I want to say maybe 2 or 3 months, one of his sons, I think it might've been Scott, had made a post on Twitter about his dad. And of course, Bob was suffering the ravages of cancer, but was still working out amazingly. And I mentioned this in another segment on the show, but his son had put like something like 30 pounds on the bench press or something like that. And for a man who worked out his whole life, that was a relatively light amount for Bob. But here he's sitting here and he's suffering from cancer. And Scott looks at his dad and says, is that okay? And Bob looks at him and says, make it 100 each side. And that no quit, not willing to, you know, to give in, Bob Armstrong. That's a story that just really stuck with me about the legacy of Bob Armstrong, as Barry mentioned, you know, the legacy. So if you could, as we close up this segment with you, Ron, and again, we really appreciate you joining us. Tell us a story that you remember about Bob having nothing to do with wrestling, just like maybe a road trip you took with him, a night you guys were sitting having dinner somewhere. Tell us a quick story of when you think about the name Bob Armstrong that you're going to remember.
Well, I got one that comes to my mind. This is a strange one, actually. I talked earlier that we had a Cadillac tournament in 1970 and ended up in the finals, ended up in the year 1977. And it was a four-door pink Cadillac, and Bob won the car. Bob and I had a deal, you know, where he got the car at a tremendous price. Anyway, we were making a trip, Bob and I, into Kentucky. When we used to run these small towns up into Kentucky that were drawing 4,000 people and 5,000 people in these towns. The population was 3,000, and there'd be 5,000 in the buildings. We were coming back one night, and Bob smoked cigarettes. He actually smoked cigarettes some, especially in the early years back in the 70s. And we were coming into Knoxville, and he had that big old pink Cadillac running about 80 miles an hour. And, you know, we're in hilly country. Knoxville up there's got a few little mountains. And we came over this hill, and we're in the fast lane, and we topped this hill, and we're running 80 miles an hour. And there was an old beat up pickup truck that was driving 25 miles an hour in our lane. And I mean, not 50 yards ahead of us. And Bob is lighting his cigarette. He's driving and he's lighting his cigarette, and he grabs the steering wheel and he just rips it real fast. We missed that car by 5 feet or less. And we go right around that car, and he whips right back into the fast lane and goes ahead and finishes lighting his cigarette. I was like, God dang, Bob. I thought we were going to die. And he said, no, I just messed up, man. You know, I'm sorry I had to light it twice. I was like, wow, man.
First of all, I can't believe there's a story involving a pro wrestler that was driving a car fast, because that just never happened.
You never see that, right? You never hear that. That's very unusual.
Yeah.
You know, everybody did. And it was really funny because we were going to get home by 10:30 or 11 o'clock anyway. You know, it wasn't like we needed to hurry. That was just the thing. When you were a wrestler, you had to go fast.
Well, listen, Ron, unfortunately, this time with you has gone a little too fast also. And on behalf of Barry and Lou, our producer, we certainly want to give you our appreciation for joining us on this special episode where we're talking about the life, the times, and the legacy of the late Bob Armstrong, your friend. And I know this is not a difficult time, or this is a difficult time for you dealing with the loss of your friend, as you know, obviously it is for the whole Armstrong family dealing with the loss of the patriarch of their family. But we do appreciate you joining us and sharing some memories, and giving us a reason to smile as we think about Bob Armstrong whipping around that guy doing 25 in the fast lane, lighting a cigarette twice. That was a great story. So thanks again, Ron. We do appreciate you joining us.
Okay. Man. Yeah. Thank you all very much. Always a pleasure to be on with you guys.
Okay. Thank you so much. Okay, Barry, we are happy on this somewhat sad occasion to be joined by CWF legend, Barry, Steve Kern, to discuss his memories and his interactions with the late Bob Armstrong. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you guys for having me on.
Yeah. So first question, begin at the beginning. When was the first time you ever had the chance to meet Bob Armstrong, if you remember?
Yeah, I remember because I went to the Georgia territory from the Florida territory, and it was right at 1974. And the reason I can remember that is because that Gordon, of course, was announcer back then for the Georgia Championship Wrestling. And out of nowhere came to me one Saturday and said, they're giving you an award today. Magazines are going to give you an award for the NWA Rookie of the Year. And I looked at him and I go, I don't want a match yet. I mean, you know, how do you get the Rookie of the Year? And he goes, well, I don't know if they feel sorry for you or they just planning on giving it to you. But that was how I can remember meeting Bob in that time period, is just because of that award and the time I got it. So, yeah, Bob was a great guy. I mean, you know, you're going to hear that time and time again. But a lot of times, you know, people don't understand that, you know, pretty much everybody in this business in that era were good guys. I mean, you know, I can't remember having any problems with anybody or anybody that, you know, you just totally disliked. But he was one of those exceptional kind of like Southern comfort guys. I mean, you know, he just had that blend of, you know, that South in him and just polite and nice and humble. And, you know, and then the whole time he's an unbelievable performer in the ring. So that was when I met him in 74. I had the opportunity to ride with him a couple of times. Can't remember, you know, like a number of times, but it seems like it was always to Columbus, Georgia, or Macon, or someplace like that. And he had a Cadillac, which was nice. I mean, you know, I was only 2 years into the business right then, so I wasn't like on the high end of the talent. So everything I did was like I was like a sponge. I was taught by some of the greatest guys in the world, but one of the things they taught me is study the guys that are in the main event. See what they're doing. Watch the reaction they get from the audience. Watch how they handle themselves. See why they're over. And so, of course, with Bob being one of the top guys there, Mr. Wrestling number two, another one, and I just kind of got into watching them. And I kind of got into watching, you know, the way he went to the ring, how he handled himself, the matches he had. They were always solid. It wasn't a match that, you know, you went out there and you go, oh, man, I'd rather not watch this. It was one of those matches that you could get into. And I was pretty easy to influence at that time in my life. And so I remember Jack Briscoe wrestling, Mr. Wrestling number two. And, I was mesmerized for an hour. And then, you know, the guys that Bob wrestled, he always seemed to handle himself so well that there was just something magic about him that you just wanted to kind of figure it out. I never really figured out everybody. I just kind of tried to imitate a little bit here, a little bit there. Even in my life, with as many people as I've taught, I tried to explain to young guys what I was taught, and it's to pick five talent that you admire, either from the growing up or your present state or whatever, and say, you know, I really like the way Bret Hart does this. I really like the way Bob Armstrong does that. I really like the way Jack Briscoe does this. And take a little bit, steal something from them. But you won't, if you take five, you won't try to identify a one, which will be a cheap imitation of them. You'll create your own character and your own, you know, style. And so Bob was right there on that list for me when I was working in Georgia in the 70s, you know, early 70s. So, you know, other than a couple of trips and, you know, his advice is probably something I can't really talk about on the air because it didn't have to do with wrestling. It had to do with other things. I mean, you know, you really, when you're in a car with the more mature guys and wrestlers, you don't really try to talk too much about wrestling. I mean, you know, it's like they have enough. So you're not going, hey, how did you get that hold? Hey, how do you do this? Or, hey, how do you do that? I can remember Tony Charles, a great wrestler from Wales. He made some unbelievable moves here in Florida when I first watched him. And I said, hey, show me how you do that. And he goes, okay, come down to the sportatorium. And I went down there and he actually, you know, worked with me. And it was easier for him to show me while wrestling me than to show me in a car or, you know, describe it. I'm not sure. I mean, another one, Billy Robinson used to tell me, because I like some of his moves, not all of them, but I like some of them. And I said, how'd you do that? And he'd just look at me and say, figure it out, kid.
Well, and imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. And, you know, you take a little bit from five guys and, you know, you make it your own. And that's part of how you become a well-rounded wrestler, I'm guessing.
Yeah. And when you're not like what I call a gimmick, you're not like just going to be the same guy for 30 years or whatever. And it's because that's your gimmick. You might be versatile enough to change like a chameleon. And one day you're a Chippendale dancer, and the next day you're a homeless alligator poacher. I mean,
it's like the same thing.
Yeah,
it's trying to understand everything, and nobody can individually teach you how to do the wrestling business and be a wrestler. But you get bits and pieces, and your most valuable parts are actually just being in the ring with different people and varieties of guys and watching, you know, and it's all under experience. So my experience was I picked up some things from Bob Armstrong, you know, and I carried them from there to Charlotte because he wasn't watching me imitate him. So when I left and went to Charlotte, North Carolina right after that, I used a few Bob Armstrong moves or gestures or whatever it was that I stole from him. But I mean, just like you said, it's the most sincere form of flattery when you pick up a few things from guys. And so, of course, when you see some of your stuff that other people are using, you're going, hey, whoa, wait a minute. Didn't I invent that? And, you know, and then they say, yeah, I stole it from you in Florida and took it to Texas.
What I was going to say was, you know, one of the things that besides his in-ring work, Bob was so well known for his promos. And, you know, when you talk about taking little things from guys in the ring, I'm guessing you also must take little things from guys that you saw. And you were certainly around some great ones, including Bob Armstrong, when they did their promos.
Oh, yeah. Promo days. And at that time, we had like, I think it was 9 times a week we were working. I mean, you know, you had a full schedule Monday through Sunday. I mean, you know, every going to each town, but you also had a TV in Atlanta, a TV on Saturday morning. Then you had to drive to Columbus, Georgia, and do an afternoon TV there for Fred Ward. And then you had to go to either Carrollton or Griffin, Georgia. And so you worked 3 times on Saturday, and you were stuck. Whether you wanted to watch it or not, you were stuck because you were at it and you had to watch everything everybody was doing. And of course, I never considered being able to imitate somebody like Bob Armstrong so far as character. He was a really smooth Southern guy from an area that he understood the people. But I was from Florida, more like a beach bum or, you know, from Port Tampa. And I'm, you know, as soon as I get that far away from the water, I'm uncomfortable. But when you listen to guys, I mean, you know, I used to just get mesmerized and say, I wish I could just speak half as good as some of these guys, because in those days, the babyface interviews had to be the most boring thing you ever listened to, except for the exceptions that knew how to handle it. Like, I can remember Gordon Solie looking at me and he'd ask me a question like, well, what do you think of the match coming up in Atlanta against you and Kevin Sullivan? Well, Mr. Solie, I'm going to do the best I can. I'm going to give 100%. and may the best man win. You know, it's like, it's like watching Peyton die. But then somebody like Bob Armstrong could take that same promo and add his emotion to it, his experience, and being able to talk to people that he was used to being around, you know, the audiences and growing up in the South. And I mean, you know, it's like Dusty. I could never figure out how Dusty was so talented. I mean, I was blessed to ride with him quite a bit in Florida, Georgia, Carolinas, everywhere, and even ended up with him his last few years of his life. But when he'd do his promos, you'd just sit there with your mouth open. And then, you know, you're going like, oh, great. Now I got to go follow that. I mean, you know, it's like the pressure's on. And back then you would do them in succession for the week. You wouldn't just do a promo for the night. You'd be doing like 5 or 6 promos that would cover the whole week of the territory. So they'd go all over. So you're talking about maybe 2 or 3 different matches, 2 or 3 different towns. And on top of that, you're trying to sound like you're interested. And, you know, I can honestly say I listened to a lot of promos of guys who were on top that weren't really that interested, like mine. But at the same time, you always knew those guys that knew how to just walk out there and they were comfortable. They just had a comfort to them. They weren't like me. I'd get off and I'd start rambling. You know, Gordon asked me a question. I'd start rambling and ramble right off the whole subject. And I can remember him being off the actual film part where he's looking at me and it's all on me. And I remember him looking at me, putting his finger in his throat and choking himself out with his hands on his throat. You know, mine would just get worse and worse. And I always admired guys like Bob that had that comfort. Man, they could go talk in front of anybody. When I was a kid, I couldn't give a book report in school. I went to school with Hulkster, Mike Graham, Dick Slater, Austin Idol. There was a lot of us that ended up in this business because we weren't really focused on school. So I got to say that interviews wasn't my best forte. Is that a word, forte?
Okay. I think you're the first one to ever actually use it on the podcast. Wouldn't that
there
be
you right? There you go.
There you go. Get new ground.
I knew I'd be first at something.
unless we've referenced Dewey Forte at some point during the show. No.
Yeah, I don't know.
I got that. I got a story about Dewey Forte too. Because I was here. I helped train Ron Simmons, Lex Luger, and Dewey Forte. Got in all at the same time. And they asked me to go to the Sportatorium, you know. And of course, when they ask you, it's not like it's a request. It's like, we're asking you, but you better come. And so you go down there like an oven. But, you know, Dewey Forte, really, he wasn't made for this business. And it was really obvious at the very beginning. We had a show in Lakeland, and it was a battle royal. And I remember Dewey Forte bought a ticket and was sitting in the audience, and everybody in the back kept saying, hey, did anybody see Dewey? Has anybody seen Dewey? And I don't know who it was. It might have been Bubba Douglas came back to the dressing room and said, he's sitting out there in the audience. And they had to go get him. And then when he got in the ring, the most famous part about this was is somebody told him while they were in all the action of the battle royal, time for you to go home. And he thought, get out and go on home. So he stepped through the ropes and just walked onto the back. And somebody said, hey, man, they let me throw you out. He goes, somebody told me to go home, so I'm going home, I guess.
And yeah, rest in peace.
Yeah, rest in peace, Dewey Forte. That is a story.
Sorry,
right there.
Sorry. So,
no, it's, yeah, we love this.
He'll forgive me because it's a true story.
Yeah, exactly. So you and Bob were actually in Florida in 19. I think this is coincidental, and I'll tell you why. You and Bob were both working in Florida in 1976. You had come back. You were getting ready for the big push. You would have the feud with the former Olympian Bob Roop, and then you would go on to get the Southern title from Jody Hamilton. But Bob Armstrong was also in the territory. I think he was dividing time between Florida and Georgia. But if I had to pinpoint when your promos kicked up, it was during that whole feud with you and Roop, because automatically you went 0 to 60 and there was this fire that just occurred.
Well, it was real. It wasn't real that it was the real angle. It was real because it was a real emotional thing in my life. I mean, when you've got something emotionally attached to it, you can really change because you've got something to say. You know, it's like, I know nobody really cares to hear this, but my last 14 years, I was a teacher. And I tried to explain, it's not memorization. You can't go out there and memorize your whole match and feed it to them. It's emotion. The people want to get emotion out of you and be emotionally attached to whether they believe it's real or not. They're going to stand up and scream. And if you're a heel, they might even take a swing at you. Now you've detached them from logic, but they've given them an emotional attachment. So the angle with Bob, when he, you know, he called my dad a coward, and my dad was home. But my dad was a prisoner in Vietnam from the time I was 13 till I was 21. And the first 3 months of him being a POW, they told me he died. I mean, they came to my house and said, I mean, I had a colonel jerk me by the arm down the hallway and say, listen, your dad died today. And I start crying and he said, you can't cry. You're the man of the family now. And I'm looking at him and going, wait a minute, I'm only 13. And he's going, your dad died today. He was shot down with the first SAM missile ever used in the war. It blew the entire F-4 that he was flying up. You got to be the man of the family. It was 3 months later, they came from United Press International, came to our house and had a picture of my dad being escorted through the streets of Hanoi. We weren't allowed to identify it because if they didn't know he was the 14th POW, they didn't know what he'd do to him. So all this emotion buildup from a 13-year-old kid right into 21 years old, I mean, you know, it was easy for me to be emotional. It was easy for me to have something interesting to say. And people wanted to hear that. They needed to hear, you know, a little girl wave American flag thing and, you know, patriot and the son, you know, and being proud of your dad. So, I you know, Bob Roop and I were with Barry not too long ago, and he was blessed. I was blessed that he brought me along to be with Bob. But Bob even explained the angle. When I dove over the desk on him, I hit my ankle on the left side, the bone that sticks out down there. It was like somebody hit it with a hammer. And it hurt, but he thought that I started kind of getting emotionally broke up because of my ankle. But that wasn't the truth. The truth was, to this day, my dad, this year was his 55th anniversary of being shot down, July 24th, 1965. It was his 55th anniversary. And whenever I speak and I try to talk about my dad and the reuniting with him and, you know, my whole life about, you know, going without a dad almost 8 years, I get emotional. And it's like, I asked my wife, I said, please don't let me cry up there, okay? I mean, you know, I'm getting really too old to be crying about this. He's been gone since 2000, so. But I don't know what to tell you guys other than this is a truthful thing to you, that when I did that angle, every time I did anything, even cage matches and lights out matches, I tried to kill Bob Roop. I physically beat him. And he was such a tough guy that he took it. But I was never, you know, one of the guys that was ever loose. I was always considered stiff. I was always considered a little bit too much, over the top. But Eddie Graham taught me, and this is what Eddie Graham said, if you don't believe in yourself, the people will never believe in you. And so I kind of took that serious when I performed in front of them. Anyway, sorry, I know I'm talking too much now.
No, that's okay.
You couldn't give me a talk at all. Now shut up.
No, and you know, you mentioned that this is something it was like real life for you. And that's something that it enabled you to connect to the audience in the same way that Bob Armstrong was able to connect with audiences, you know, whether he was doing his promos or showing the fire. And then that fire that's inside that you can bring forth. And, you know, allows the audience, whether it's at ringside or the guy that's up in the upper deck, that allows them to connect with you. It's what made you great during your career. It's what made Bob Armstrong great during his career.
Well, that's a nice compliment. I don't know about being great. I survived. And, you know, here's the thing that you learn in this industry is there's a lot of family ties and there's a lot of political part to it, because it, who knows who knew who was in what territory, who was a booker here, who was a booker there. And I can honestly say I didn't have anybody. I swam through the sea of sharks like a minnow through each territory and had to change like a chameleon going from one territory to the other. But guys like Bob Armstrong gave me a seed. Something in whatever I got out of Bob was a seed planted in my head, and it helped me go forward. And I remember going from Atlanta to Tennessee, and Kevin Sullivan and I were drafted at the Omni. They were trying to get Tommy Rich back into Atlanta because he had gone to Tennessee, and Jerry Jarrett didn't really want him, and said, I'll come to Atlanta to Jim Barnett, and said, Barnett says, I'll give you any two guys you can pick out on the card that night and for a trade for Tommy Rich. Well, Kevin Sullivan and I had an angle going on, and you know how Kevin is. Kevin, he wants to not just keep it in the ring. We went to the top of the Omni and rolled all through to people. But when we went to Tennessee in our angle, I'd never wrestled in a territory like that. I mean, you know, I went from the NWA, real strong Florida wrestling, same as Georgia wrestling, same as the Carolinas wrestling with the Anderson brothers. And then all of a sudden, now I'm in Tennessee where the loser eats a can of dog food. And I'm going, wait a minute. I mean, what happened? I
said, wait a minute, you mean Eddie Graham didn't do that kind of stuff, Steve?
Oh, no, man. Eddie Graham was so strict and such a disciplinarian. I mean, my first 6 months of working out, when he asked me if I wanted to get in the business, was a real eye-opener, because they just beat the shit out of me every day at that sportatorium, and I'd come home with mat burns on my elbows, my cheeks. I was never hit in the face or, you know, really tortured too bad, but I was beat up. And my mom would look at me and she'd go, wow, I thought wrestling was fake. And I look at her and I say, me too. I don't know what I'm learning, but it ain't what I see on TV. I can tell you that right now. But it was the way to make you respect the business and defend the business. Because once you made it through there and got started, if anybody challenged you, that wrestling's not, that's all fake. You're going, let's go outside and find out. And that's the way Eddie taught here in Florida. And, you know, anybody could tell you that, but I lived it. Old Matt Suter, I thought for sure he thought my dad had dropped a bomb on Japan when he was working out with me. Because he was like, he'd stretch me. And when I back then you didn't have tapping out. You just said, ow, that hurts. Stop. I give anything. And he just smiled like, you know, like he was really having fun doing it. And, you know, I was never a big fan of his, but after I got into the business and, you know, got going to other territories, but I guess it was part of your education.
Yeah. Well, listen, Steve, we want to tell you how much we appreciate you coming on, discussing not only your career, but your friendship with the late Bob Armstrong. You know, those car rides with the advice he'd give you that had nothing to do with wrestling. And so I'm sure everyone out there is like going, what the heck did he tell him?
Well, we want to hear those stories, actually. Exactly.
Yeah, well, you know, before I get off, too, there's more to it than just talking about Bob, because if Bob was awesome in the ring and out of the ring, and what a great person he was, and somebody that no matter who you are, if you rode with him a couple hundred miles, you'd walk away loving the guy. But I've been a part of his whole family, from Road Dogg to Steve to Brad to, I mean, you know, the whole group. I mean, Scott, I've known all of his kids, and I've worked with his kids for years. And they all have the same kind of ethics that Bob had. And, you know, you don't get that from a dad that's not paying attention. You get that from a dad that, you know, okay, well, you can step out of line this far, but I'm getting ready to smack you back into the line, you know? So he was not only a great athlete, a great wrestler, a great man, but he raised great kids, too. And, you know, I'm just blessed to have known all the Armstrongs and had a part, you know, of working with them or around them all my life. So, thank you guys for having me on.
No, and maybe that's ultimately the greatest tribute to Bob is the fact that he raised some great kids, and you know, that reflects well not only on Bob but on his wife, their mom, and maybe more than wrestling, the way that he raised his children is the ultimate legacy of Bob Armstrong. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Okay, well, thanks for having me, Jeff and Barry. Thanks very much.
Okay.
All right.
Barry, I know that you you join with me in thanking the four gentlemen who joined us this week for some really glowing tributes of their friend Bob Armstrong.
Yeah, that was just listening to the words, you know, of the people that worked with him, the people that he worked, you know, day in and day out, the respect level that his peers had for him. And, you know, there were some words there. I know that Steve Kern said it, and I know Ron Fuller said it, and I believe Nick Patrick said it as well. And Les Thatcher, Bob Armstrong was a great human being. And all of that, everything else, great professional wrestler, whatever, he was a great human being. And that right there should be the legacy.
Yeah. And not only that, but I think, as I said, also a great father, and maybe ultimately more than being a great wrestler or a great promo guy or even a great friend, the fact that he was such a great father and raised four really great young men, that probably is his ultimate legacy and something that he and his late wife should be very proud of. So on behalf of my co-host Barry Rose and our producer, the sweet man, Lou Kippelman, I'd like to thank you all for joining us this week and remind you that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And we will see you next week, folks.